Like, say, like, are set up with this crazy problem where you have to ask this question. Did Jesus proclaim the gospel? Which is insane. Like, because of, you would say, obviously he did. But our definition of what the good news of Jesus is actually doesn't include the thing that Jesus thought was the best news, which was his very presence in our lives.
Welcome to the We Collide podcast. We're a growing community of everyday chicks colliding with Jesus in our mess, our pain, our joy, and our stories. We value showing up as we truly are, so that's what you'll find here. Walls and masks being torn down so that we can allow Jesus to meet us where we truly are and hear about other women doing the same. We can't wait to collide with you.
Welcome to the We Collide podcast. I'm Willow Weston, the founder and director of Collide, and I'm so excited to have today's guest on the pod. This man's full of passion for God and passion for people to know God, and the way that he thinks about Jesus and what it looks like to follow him will challenge us in all the ways that we need challenging. This man has an amazing wife and loads of kids. He lives in community and loves like Jesus. He has a stunning insight on the gospel based on his life experience. He leads a ministry called Ecclesia, and when he gets excited, he snaps his fingers.
I do.
He has a podcast of his own. He's a teacher, a preacher, a lover of pop culture and how it connects to God, a dad, a husband, and a friend to all. And Garrett, Shelsta, welcome to the We Collide podcast.
I am so excited to be here. Big fan.
Oh.
So it's a privilege to be on here.
Oh, thanks, man.
Yeah.
Well, I always love getting coffee with you.
So it's true. Just, we do like, have a lot of fun.
I don't have my coffee in here, but you do.
I do. I have my coffee.
So when I asked some people leading up to today to describe why you're so cool.
Yes.
I did this, right? I did a little research right. And I'm like, why is this guy so cool? There's so many things.
It's the tight pants. It's really.
Skinny jeans?
Yeah, that's it.
Oh my gosh, we're already digressing.
Sorry.
No. I was going to talk about the first time I took my husband shopping. For non-pleated Dockers.
Oh my God.
I'm not going to talk about that right now. But anyways, I asked people, what is it about him that's so cool? And one of the things that was said about you is that you believe, teach, and live a gospel that says God loves people who we don't.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Can you tell me about why you're so passionate about that?
Yeah. Well, probably two parts of my own personal story that has really led me down that path. Is first, I'm half Filipino and half white. And so as a person of color, it was kind of a weird way that like I kind of embraced that part of my identity. But I mean, so I'm half and half. So like the thing I often will tell people is growing up as half Filipino, half white in the white suburbs of Denver, which is where I grew up,
mm-hmm.
I was never white enough for my white friends and I was never brown enough for my brown friends. And so I like always had this kind of like, I kind of felt like a cultural immigrant, like in brown spaces, I felt too white in white spaces. I felt too brown. And so like, it was like, I always just felt like a little unsettled in my own personhood and identity as I navigated. And I remember having this really distinct moment. I went to college in LA and we were in, we lived in East Los Angeles and I was out at the mall with all of my friends who were all white. And then I was surrounded by advertisements of all white people, but everyone in the mall was brown, all Latino for the most part. Mm. And I like looked around and it was a really strange existential moment. Like all of a sudden being like, I look more like the brown people in the mall than my friends or the advertisements. And that's when I really started kind of like unlocking like what it meant. Like, and I was like 19, 20 years old at that point.
So that was like 2 years ago.
I'm 36. So
okay. I just wanted to give people some
confidence. Right. I do tell people being brown means I age great. My mom looks incredible. My nana looks awesome. So that's a part of it. And like when I started digging more into that, like on my mom's side of the family, she's full Filipino. I mean, like, it's hard. The Philippines were conquered by everybody. So, like, there's, like part Irish, part Spanish, like, in her blood. But, like, for the most part, like, she's, like, all brown. But, like, on my grandmother's side, I'm the first person to graduate college. And how hard that was for that, like, that's three generations of people that lived in this country before one of their, like, their great grandkids went to college. And then I started talking to my grandmother about, like, they lived in this spot in Palm Springs where they grew up. Like, what I tell people that my grandma lives in Palm Springs. They're like, oh, how nice. I'm like, no, she doesn't live in the part of Palm Springs that you probably go to. She lives in a place they called the Dream Homes, which was named ironically because it was where it was essentially during redlining in the 1940s and 50s, they put all the brown people that work service industry in Palm Springs. And they put these huge trees that grew up around it, so no one had to look at it. And growing up, that's just all I knew. And so, like, when my friends told me, like, "Oh, that's so much fun! Palm Springs is so nice," I'm like, I remember playing in a wash in the desert, like this, like area where all the floodwaters blade, and like, you know, like, and we only went in the summer, so it was like 120 degrees. So, you know, I mean, so like that was a part of just how I grew up was understanding that kind of. Piece, but I didn't really have language until I was a little bit older of what that was like. So that's one. Two is my youngest brother is a person with a disability. His name's Taylor, and he's a person with Down syndrome. And that was more formative in like early stages of my life. Mm. That for growing up with a person with a disability in your family, like it just reframes everything that you think about the world. Mm-hmm. From how, like, what a person is to, like, what makes humans humans, like, what is the good, like, how does someone come into, like, the kingdom of God if you're a person with a disability? And what does Jesus mean to a person with a disability? Like, what is the good news of God's, like, rule and reign coming if you're a person with special needs? And so it really reframed everything on how I just look at theology, how I look at church, to how I look at politics, like not necessarily policy, but just like even the way that we define what a human is oftentimes comes around with like a level of rationality. Like the way that we are able to make decisions in representative democracies like ours is like you get the most information that you possibly can, and then you go into a booth where then you mark, I think that this is based on the information that I have, I make this decision about what I want my community to go forward. Which essentially excludes people with disabilities from helping make decisions about their own destiny and their own future and their, you know, so which I just think is so interesting because ultimately that's a formative act that tells us what it means to be human. And so being human means being more rational or having more information or being able to make autonomous decisions. And people with disabilities, like specifically Taylor, like change that. And so in most spaces that I go into, like I just try to occupy a space that advocates for people on the margins. And that's hard oftentimes for me because like I also want to belong. Like and have like connection and belonging and friendship or relationship. But I also oftentimes will push people pretty hard on some things that they can do. So I don't know if that makes me cool. It makes me conflicted.
Okay. There's a lot there. I want to talk about a lot of things. Tell me about, let's talk more about what you learned from Taylor. What's the age difference between you guys?
Taylor, so I'm 36. Taylor just turned 20. He's 8 years younger. So I mean, that makes me 27, 28.
So you're 8 years old. You were in third grade and Taylor was born. And what do you remember about that? Because that was like a complete shift when you say reframing.
Yeah.
You're 8 years old and you're anticipating a little brother.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So we were actually, so I grew up in Arizona and then we spent my dad worked for this organization. It's called Up With People. Some people might be familiar with it. It's like
Up With The People.
Up With People.
Up With The People.
Right. Up With People is like this humanitarian organization that like organizes around a Broadway style musical. It's a weird thing, but I grew up in it. Like this.
Yeah,
I grew up in it. Both my parents were performers. And, So they had this big performance that was in Denver that my dad was helping facilitate. And And so we lived in Denver for a year, moved from Arizona to Denver. And Taylor was actually born at the end of our stint there. We were about to pack up and move. And my little brother was born. There's a lot that actually surrounded it that I didn't know until later. Like my mom's health got super bad and all these different things. And it was, I remember having to go to my grandparents' house in Casper, Wyoming, of all places. And for a few days while my mom had the baby, and then we came back. And I remember going to the hospital. It's weird having a daughter that's the same age now, mm-hmm. As I was, because I have these vivid memories. Going to the hospital, and Taylor was in this like incubation kind of thing under some lights. And my mom looked at me, I think they were trying to contextualize what Down syndrome was. Like, he's going to look more Asian. Because I guess actually, Down syndrome people used to be called Mongolese, because that was like, they just, when they were born, they looked very Asian, which was weird also because we're Filipino. And I'm like, you know, like, mom, how do you look more Asian than us who are Asian? And we were like, I remember going there and not really understanding it. And they were describing it to us. But I actually remember earlier on, like, maybe I was annoyed with my brothers and sisters. I remember praying. We grew up Catholics. We were in church and we were praying. And I prayed for a little brother who would stay a little brother forever, because maybe my little brother is annoying me or something. And and that's kind of what I got. And like throughout the rest of my experience, I mean, like, Taylor is in a state of arrested development around 8 to 12, depending on how, like, where he is that day. And yeah, so that's what I remember. And growing, and then just growing up with him, there's a lot of things that were hard. I mean, like, I grew up in a family of five. Taylor's the youngest. My dad traveled a lot, and so my mom was home with five kids probably 2 weeks out of the month. Like, it was a lot. Wow. And
so she's a superhero.
Yeah, she really is pretty incredible. Like, having four kids now and realizing how hard that is with two of us around fairly frequently, and like seeing, like, when I go out of town to like go on a retreat or speak or something, like how hard that is on Aubrey. I can't imagine what that is for multiple years on my mom. It's just incredible. I remember it being hard because there's a lot of us in that house and all of us are doing our own things. My mom is taking care of us. And there were like lots of times when we moved back to Arizona and then we moved back up to Denver. My dad's whole company relocated. Being in our house in Denver, and Taylor would just walk out the door and just disappear into the neighborhood. And all of us are like, what happened? Like, where did he go? Like, my mom's cooking us lunch, and like all of us are doing different things, and then Taylor's gone. We had to like install an alarm on our door so we could hear when it opened and closed, because it started happening as soon as he could start to walk. I think all of it just changed the posture of our whole family of like, oh, we have to really center around for a season how we all take care of Taylor. So I would also say that it drew us really close together as a family, probably in a way that we probably wouldn't have had otherwise, that we have this kind of unique bond around the strangeness of having a brother with a person with a disability. Yeah. It really reoriented a lot of how we operated and looked at and lived as a family. Even to this day, like, our text messages are like 30% about the weird things Taylor puts on in our parents' house, and then like does a dance in the living room. It's just, he still is a formative piece of our relationship.
Right. Yeah. So tell me about the memories you have, or your first memories of recognizing that somehow he was more misunderstood or mistreated.
Sure.
Than maybe you or some of your other siblings.
Right. So that I never, probably when I was in middle school and high school, it never occurred to me that Taylor was mistreated, because he had such an incredible support system around him. Mm-hmm. In our family, the way that we cared for him. My parents never shied away from having a conversation about what was hard for Taylor, or what you know, I think that there were, but it was just what we did. Like mm-hmm. we survived is not the right word, but like we just lived with a person with,
it was
like,
your story.
Just normal. It was mm-hmm. just a normalized thing. It wasn't until I started really studying theology and biblical studies that I really began to understand that Taylor's predicament, if he didn't have a crew of people that were advocating for him mm-hmm. constantly and continually, how easily it would be that he's just literally shoved to the side, to the margins. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like out of my own personal, like there wasn't like a moment or a story mm-hmm. that I saw Taylor mistreated. Mm-hmm. Taylor, I would think for the most, like he was never bullied. He was like, because also he had a squad, like there's four siblings.
Right.
And so there was a squad of people that were always around him advocating for him. So that was never part of his story. But then when I started like looking at like the systematic issues, like even in our own theological or church tradition that we're in, how he's excluded from engaging, that's when I started really understanding it from like more of a cerebral place.
Right. Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because when you do look at Jesus in the New Testament uh-huh. and you look at who he collides with,
right,
it's often these people that we avoid and sure. do push to the side.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would say pretty much exclusively.
Yeah.
You know, like I think that's right. Like someone should start an organization where like you just look at how Jesus collides with the outsider. Someone should do that.
Yeah, someone told me that. I don't know who's going to do it. Maybe we can call it Up With The People.
Up With The People, right. Yeah, I mean, so once I, like, and, you know, I mean, growing up in church in the way that, like, I grew up Catholic. And so, like, sometimes the, like, and maybe you feel this similar knowing a little bit of your story, like, I don't really understand the evangelical subculture thing a lot. Like, only in like, once again, maybe in my, like as a cultural immigrant, because I didn't come to know the Lord until in like an evangelical space until I was 13 or 14. And even then I was still kind of going to Catholic church and right. going to my like youth group. But I never understood like the Christian subculture thing. But growing, like even just hearing it and seeing it, like, there is oftentimes so much emphasis placed around like a moment of conversion mm-hmm. that oftentimes is like built up around you feeling super shameful and guilty about your life, all the ways that you've failed. And it just creates this shame bubble around you. As a like almost like a convincing method. And once you build up this big shame bubble, like in the preacher, like talks about all the bad things that you've done. And then, but luckily, even though like the preacher will do something like, but luckily, even though you're like a pile of garbage, like to quote Martin Luther, you're a pile of crap covered in like, you're just a pile of crap. Luckily Jesus comes and then blankets you over. And then you're like, you get this like emotional release for all your shame. Mm-hmm. And that's great. That's fantastic. That's great. I really want to be released from all the shameful things.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I want my shame bubbles to pop.
I want that, right? However, how do you like how? And then that's the good news, that your shame is removed. Mm-hmm. That is good news, and that is true. But how do I convince Taylor that he's full of shame? Like, mm-hmm. There's nothing there. Or like the other way that you'll talk about it, it's like a math problem, like. You take all of the bad things that humanity has done throughout the entire world, and that like equals negative infinity badness. But luckily, to get us back to like operating level, infinity came, Jesus, and took all of the badness and on the cross somehow disarmed it, right? But what's crazy about that, like that math problem, is that just gets you to zero. Like, you know, that doesn't like give you freedom. That just gets you back to like a zero balance, which then actually sets you up to think like, oh, now I just do more things and I'm in the positive balance, which is a actually super counterintuitive to what Jesus did. And so all of that stuff, like, okay, so if you agree that you are at negative infinity and then Jesus gave you infinity, and if you agree to that math problem, then you're in the kingdom of God. Like, explain that to Taylor. And so I think that those were the moments most likely for me that I started rethinking, like, whoa, like Jesus is about something profoundly different because of my relationship with my little brother. And once again, I'm not saying that any of those things are necessarily wrong. I'm just not saying they're final. They're not the end all of what Jesus did.
Not the whole story.
Right. In addition to that, like, it creates a crazy problem for Jesus too, because like, if that's the gospel, if that's the good news, then Jesus never proclaimed the gospel because he was only talking about the good news of Jesus before his death. Like, so you like are set up with this crazy problem where you have to ask this question, did Jesus proclaim the gospel? Which is insane. Like, because you would say, obviously he did. But our definition of what the good news of Jesus is actually doesn't include the thing that Jesus thought was the best news, which was his very presence in our lives. The coming of a new reality where we can be authentically human with all of our shame, all of our brokenness, all of our hurt and pain. And we get accepted into that community, no matter where we come from, what we've been through, how we identify, what language we speak, what our ethnic heritage is. Everyone has a part to play in what God's doing in the world. And the good news is we can come together because of what Jesus did and defeated the great enemy death and discover what it looks like to be authentic humanity here and now and into eternity. Like, that's the good news. And that language of participation and that language of the kingdom, that's where Taylor fits in. Because then he has an integral part to play, an integral way to teach us what it means to be human. So, sorry, that's my little soapbox.
No, it's awesome. We talk a lot about it at Collide, like, Jesus meets you where you're at. Mm-hmm. And I think that sounds so basic, but it's really not what a lot of us have been taught.
Right.
I mean, I think we kind of, the capital C church in a lot of ways in the last couple of decades has taught a theology that says kind of get it together.
Right.
Deal with that shame bubble.
Yes.
Go get your life right. Go have that conversion moment and then come back to Jesus. And it's like, no. Like, we need to allow Jesus to meet us where we're at.
Right.
And it's in that relationship and in that walking side by side and in a journey that he does that work.
Yeah,
right? Please. Are you snapping?
Yeah, I'm snapping.
I wish I could snap. You hear that snap? skinny jeans on the snap. So we talk about that a lot. Like, no, Jesus meets you where you're at and walks with you to where he wants you to be.
Yes.
And so I love the idea of like God coming down. And if God is love, love me too where you're at.
Right.
He meets your brother where he's at.
That's
and
right.
does life with him.
Right. You know, we're teaching through this passage in John where Jesus is essentially praying for
at Ecclesia.
At Ecclesia.
Okay. Ministry.
We're teaching through this passage and we're talking about like this prayer that Jesus prays for his followers right before he goes to his cross. One of the things that happens early in John, it's like John 17, like in 1 through 12, because that's what I'm preaching on this week, is he says, like, he's praying for his disciples and he uses this term. He says, in the past tense, they have glorified, as I have glorified you, they have glorified you. Meaning in like all of the ways that Peter hadn't gotten it right multiple times through the Gospel of John, he misunderstood, misspoke, all the ways that that they completely missed the mark, they didn't understand, they didn't live right, they
even argued over who was best.
All of those things.
Yeah.
Even in all of that mess, Jesus says, they glorified you. And it's not saying that like their wrongness glorifies God, but like that doesn't disqualify them from disqualifying Jesus, which I think that that's such a freeing thing to hear, that you don't have to like clean everything up first in order to bring it to Jesus. And then you're like, okay, let's go. You know, right. Like he just, yeah, he just meets you wherever you're at. So
right. Fun. Totally. Yeah. And it's also not a one-time thing. Like I met Jesus 20 right. years ago and that's haven't right. really needed him since.
Right.
That's kind of a mess.
That's true. Talk totally. About
terrible advertising. Yeah. Oh my God.
Right.
You're just walking around bleeding and making everyone bleed around you in the name of Jesus.
I had this, there's this, I was meeting with this student at Ecclesia and they were just so concerned about if they could like lose their salvation. They were very concerned about it. Like mm-hmm. really, like, what if I stop believing? Like, did I lose my salvation? Or I have doubts. Did I lose my salvation? Like, well, if you're asking the question, probably not. But then I asked her a simple question is like, when did Peter get saved? Like, when was the point in Peter's life that mm-hmm. he came to saving knowledge of Jesus? Was it the point that he left the nets? Was it the point that he said, Jesus, you are the Christ? Was it the point that he walked on the water? Was it the point that after he denied Jesus and saw and had like breakfast with him on the beach that he's, was it the point that Paul confronted him about the Jews not eating at the table? Where did Peter get saved? And we don't really have that idea. Well, partially that's because it's like every day. This, my mom always said, like, she's like, my mom's Catholic and she always like gave me a hard time and like my 16-year-old self. Like, Garrett, like, I know you feel like you've been saved, but getting saved is a thing that you ask every single day. And she was mm-hmm. right. Mm-hmm. She was totally right. Like, that is, it is a continual moment of every day deciding and choosing to follow Jesus. I think that's why Jesus, like, talk about bad advertising. He says, like, pick up your cross and follow me. Hey, pick up that thing that is a torturous execution daily and follow me. Mm-hmm. That is being saved. So like, and that was like his like, come follow me speech. Like, that's like not a good right. advertising campaign.
It's a funny thing because my son, Aiden, when he was maybe 3 years old, sure. we were driving in the car and he asked me where God was. And I said, God is everywhere.
Yeah.
I said, look out the window, see the trees, sure. see the car, see that person crossing the street, see right. the clouds in the sky. God is everywhere. Yeah. There's nowhere you can go that God isn't.
Right.
And I said, God even says he'll come and make his home inside of you yes. and live inside of you right. if you want him to.
Right.
And we went out for Cold Stone ice cream. You know, you get a mix your own ice cream, whatever. Right. That's like a big deal when you're three. And then later that night, I was tucking him into bed and he's like, I want God to live inside me Whoa. With the gummy bears. I was like, sweet, that's awesome.
Yeah, do yeah. that.
So I was like, hey, God, Aiden wants you to live inside of him with the gummy bears. And that, and it was as simple as that yeah. in that moment.
Yeah, sure.
But I think it was like 1 year later, I signed him up for VBS
sure.
in town. And he came home on 4 days in, right? They kind of do the build up, I sure, guess. Sure. I wasn't a church kid, so
I don't know
how this works.
Yeah, they're about to build up the shame bubble. Right. What about
to do. 4 days in, he comes home and we had out of town guests and he's beside himself, which was unusual. And so I went up
like
to
upset his beside himself or yeah. excited? Okay.
Upset.
Yeah.
Because, and I started to probe. I went up to his room and asked him questions. And he was so upset because they asked all the kids who, you know, who wanted to give their life to God. And any kid that raised their hand would get some toys and a Bible.
Whoa.
And he couldn't raise his hand because he already said that prayer with me before. And so he was kicked. But he couldn't get a present. And I had a moment sure. where I realized, wow, like somehow like we're getting this wrong because I was talking to Aiden. He's yeah. like four.
Sure.
And I'm like, Aiden, mom and dad, we asked God into our life for like for the first time, one right. time, but I have to ask God to be with
That's
me
right.
all day, every day.
Right.
And that is something that I want to invite my kids into, right. a faith that's like, I need God every day, yeah. all day. But somehow we're glorifying and saying like, just build it up to this one sure. moment and you get toys
sure.
and then never talk to him again. Sure. Where here's this kid who's like, I invite him into my life every day, all day. And I talk to him.
Right.
He's in there with the gummy bears and we're doing this thing, but he doesn't deserve toys.
Right.
And so we teach some weird things.
Yeah.
In our faith.
You know, and I'm not
like it's confusing.
It does. It is confusing when we make it final, right? Like when we say that like this is the absolute way it is. Like, because I'm not like we do call this salvation at Ecclesia.
Yeah. Yeah.
you know, a few times a year. Like, I'm not against putting that in. It's just like, but that's not like the moment, like, you signed the contract. Like,
well, it's not like sayonara, God. That was great. I totally had a moment where I needed to commit and say, Lord, I hand you my life and I give you my life, but I need to give him my life every day.
Right.
Or I'm hosed by 1 p.m.
Absolutely. Right. But I mean, like, also, like, it's maybe the, and perhaps this is such a profound metaphor that happens all throughout the Bible, is that God talks about his relationship with Israel or his relationship with the church as like a marital relationship.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps it's more like, yeah, there was a moment back in the day where Aubrey, my wife and I, we committed to one another in a very profound way.
Mm-hmm.
And that moment was beautiful and awesome, and the wine was flowing and the beats were bumping and we had so much fun. But, like, that changes the moment that Aubrey, like, finds out her husband, me, has a pornography addiction that's resurfaced in the marriage, you know?
Mm.
That then all of a sudden, like, that moment, you have to re-choose. Mm. So, and so that moment becomes more of a, like, in your psychology, it's no longer, like, saving. It's a commitment that you made that now you're saying, I'm re-upping that commitment. It becomes, and this is part of the reason that I think it's super important to do this in the context of a community or with friends or family or people that know you,
mm-hmm.
is that we then, as we make that commitment publicly, we then down the road, when it becomes difficult, we can be reminded of the commitment that we had no idea what we were committing to when we were doing it. Like, so, like, right. Maybe in the context, so one of my favorite ethicists is a guy named Stanley Hauerwas, and he talks about it like this. He says, like, that the reason that you make a public marriage declaration or a public declaration of baptism is that you have no idea what you're doing in that moment. Like, how would you know what it means to live in monogamous lifelong fidelity to someone when Aubrey and I got married when I were like 22 and 21? Right. We have no idea what that means with
right.
four kids in a job where we don't live in the same place that we no, you have no idea. But you make that commitment in front of a community of people so that down the road when it's hard, you can go to that community of people and say, this is hard. And they can remind you of that commitment
mm-hmm.
when you had no idea what you were committing to. And so that's the same thing. Like, that's why I think the moments are important, not because it creates like some sort of grand metaphysical moment where the scales tip or whatever.
Right.
But it's a moment that you can point to and say, that was the moment that a community of people, I made a public declaration, and right now it's hard. And I can point to that moment and say that was the moment that I decided to change.
Right.
That was the moment I decided to allow God to direct my life.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, it's a moment you can hang your hat on
yes.
and say, I chose you.
Yeah.
I committed to you, and I want this, and I'm in it for the journey. And I think that's why I love, and I want to talk to you about your ministry, Ecclesia. Your tagline is "No perfect people allowed."
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we're getting off on this conversation about a one-time conversion versus a lifetime with Jesus.
We're going somewhere.
But why that's interesting that ties in with your tagline is that I think sometimes that one-time conversation, that one-time conversion makes you feel like, oh, now I have to nail this thing.
Yes.
And therefore, I'm in it 5 years later, and liken it to the marriage relationship. And then when trouble comes and hardship and temptation and sin and mess up, you think you've completely blown it, and that commitment meant nothing when that's not true.
That's
you're on a journey in a relationship with someone, and it happens to be God.
Yeah.
And you happen to not be perfect.
Right.
Right. So tell me about that. Your guys's, you know, huge value of no perfect people allowed.
Yeah. So I didn't. That was a gift that the pastor before me that kind of founded Ecclesia, a guy named Brian McSwan, him and his staff came up with that tagline. And I inherited that, and I'm grateful for it, because it has been kind of a guiding cultural value for us that I'm profoundly thankful for. And it has been helpful. I think that one, it, I mean, it's a helpful conversation. I like, we go up to, so at Western Washington University here in Bellingham, they have this thing called the Red Square Info Fair, and like all the freshmen are there. And then all the upperclassmen are there too, but they just want free things.
Right. I've been there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's me. So like, there's like thousands of college kids. Like if you didn't go to college, literally picture that scene in Pitch Perfect where there's like a bunch of booths and people singing at you. And there's like, and what I tell people is I'm like, it's essentially the same thing with slightly less acapella because there's still acapella. So like, it's still happening. So you go up there and it's a great conversation starter because like people who don't have any context for faith will come up and be like, I'm not perfect. What's this? And like, you tell them it's a church and they're like, I don't like this, but you're giving me a free hot dog. So I'm going to listen to you. So yeah, so I think that it is an easy way for people to feel comfortable to walk into a church for the first time. And so that's kind of how it's played culturally, but it's been more formative than that across the board for us. Because it, I mean, just even given everything that I just said and how I think and process about the Christian life. Yeah. Like this is a space that no matter where you come from, where you've been, like you can figure it out here. You really can. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that everything goes. Like we believe that there's particular ways that we live and speak and things that we care about that like honor God. And mm-hmm. we want to proclaim that, not just with the way that we think and the way that we pray and the way that we live our private lives, but also in the way that we operate in the world. Mm-hmm. And so that like, so one thing that we have at our church community here in Bellingham at Christ the King is it's okay to not be okay, but it's not okay to stay that way. Meaning like, hey, it's fine. Come as a mess. You can be a mess for however long, but God's calling you to something more than your mess. Mm-hmm. God's calling you that out of your particular set of messes that you've made, God is taking that beauty, turning it into ashes in a way that only your life can bring him glory. Like, which is just so profound to open up to people. But we do walk through a lot of messes with people and help them discover how God is going to transform and change that. And that doesn't mean that the consequences for their decisions goes away. It doesn't mean that it's easier. Like we said, like it is picking up your cross daily, but that God is like restoring all things, including our lives. So
mm-hmm. I love that. I mean, I always say like, you can't stay the same and go with God. And I think sometimes people wonder, I've even been in this place, like, why am I so stuck?
Sure.
And I think sometimes it's because we settle for, yeah, God meets me where I'm at and this is where I'm at. I am a, like, just a big ball of anxiety and it's never going to change. Right. And I think God has a greater invitation for us. Like, he doesn't want us to stay having constant anxiety and constant anxiety attacks and panicking and not sleeping and all those things. Like, he wants to invite us into freedom.
Yes.
And so often we can stay in that place, but Jesus is like, no, come with me. Right. But at the same time, sometimes the church, I think Christians put sort of like a timestamp on it.
Right.
Like, you can be imperfect.
Right.
But only for like a couple months after you give your life to God, or only like a month or two after you confess it's a problem, or so we timestamp it.
Yes.
And we don't have grace and patience for each other when someone else's journey is taking longer to nail it than we think it ought to.
That's so true. That is the epitome of judgment. Hmm. Right? Like, when we don't allow God to do the work God is doing in the time frame that he has. So C.S. Lewis has this really incredible talk about like why we don't judge. It's in Mere Christianity. And he says that you don't know where someone started and where they are now. So he puts it on a linear scale. So like the way that I teach this like 6-month discipleship course for young adults.
Can I jump in?
Yeah, you can. I'll get.
Can you scratch that young?
Yeah, it can be for anyone. Sure. Well, if you want to come, it's totally fine. Anytime you want. But like, so the way he has a different analogy, but it's super British in the 1940s. And so it's not very helpful for like young people in Bellingham, Washington. So I like say like, what if your whole life you were told kicking puppies was an okay thing? Okay. And you move to a spot, like as you progress through your life, you come to know Jesus, and then you get to the spot where you're like, okay, I don't think kicking puppies is okay. And I am going to just like you're talking like the worst end of the spectrum, and you moved to totally neutral about puppies. You're like, okay, puppies are, I am neutral about puppies. But let's say you started out a spot at neutral, and then you moved to, I kind of like dogs. Who moved farther? The person that started at, like, that is a profound farther way to move than someone who looks better on the outside. The person that's like, oh, I'll pet a dog. Hmm. That person looks way better
right.
than the person that just is like, I'm neutral about puppies. But who went farther? So the issue is that God is the one that knows the spectrum.
Right.
The full spectrum. I went to Bible school, and like most people in Bible, I don't know, maybe if most, there's a pretty standard story, I feel like, of kids that went to Bible school that have just totally walked away from the faith. That they learn some things about the Bible or who God is, and they're like, it just totally shattered their perception of who God is. So they walked away totally. So I had this, I play fantasy football with a group of my guy friends from college. And I was telling them about a friend of mine in Bellingham who has a stepdad. And this stepdad started out in a biker gang, like a racist biker gang. And for whatever set of circumstances, he ended up going to prison. He met Jesus in prison, got out of prison, quit dealing drugs, quit being in a racist biker gang, and started a recovery group at his local church. If you went to his Facebook wall and looked at it, it would be the most like stereotypical echo chamber of conservative Christianity and cultural conservatism in the world. Like I went to it, I'm like, oh yeah, like I could understand why that would drive me nuts. But homeboy started as a racist drug dealing biker gang member, and now he's moved to a stereotypical culturally conservative. Yeah, like sure, that's some of it's still not great, but at the same time, it's like look how far he came, and Jesus knows that. And so it's less about like it's like, are we going to have that level of compassion, not knowing where they come from, and actually releasing people of their other like social and political proclivities because we don't know where they came from. And we need to have that level of grace with one another to open that up, open that space up to know that God is walking that story with everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So
anyway. I love that statement. You don't know where they began.
Yeah.
And to remind yourself that I think some of the greatest kind of worldview sort of mind blowing, my worldview shaken up moments are when I'm actually entering into spaces that I wouldn't normally enter sure. into, and I'm engaging people that I wouldn't normally engage. And I realize that I have no idea.
Right.
And these people that I've been judgmental, I'll never forget. I was leading a mission trip of young adults
yeah.
up in Canada, and there was this man, it was mid-morning, and he's wandering around in the rain, and he was completely drunk.
Right.
And he was lost, and he was like, can you help me find my way home?
Oh, yeah.
And I started to talk to this guy, and long story short, he starts opening up, and he was a professional hockey player.
Whoa.
And he had everything. He had the mansion, right. the kids, the car, the house, anything materialistically yeah. that he wanted, an amazing career. He was well-known on Canadian professional hockey team.
Right.
And his wife got in a car accident and died. And he started sobbing to me and these college students because he taught her how to drive.
Oh.
And he said it's his fault.
Yes.
Like, yeah. it's my fault.
Right.
I'll never forget myself. Yeah. And he walked.
Right.
And it had been like 10 years. He hadn't seen his kids. he left his city, he left his team, right. And here he is, and he's drinking himself into an oblivion. Yeah. And it was this moment where I was like, Willow, you have no idea.
Yeah, right.
Like, you have no idea. And I think sometimes we think like, no, this person should not be drunk right. at 9:30 a.m. wandering around with a bag of greasy chicken asking where their house is, yeah, you know? Right. But we do that with each other Absolutely. In the church. We do that with friends. We do that with neighbors. Right. We do that with family members.
Yes.
And we don't know.
Yeah.
We have no idea where right. they began.
Yeah. And that doesn't, and I'm not saying that that means that we don't challenge and push and shape.
And invite.
And
yeah.
invite. But in no world does that mean that they're disqualified from what God is doing in the world. None.
Right.
The moment that we start believing that, that those actions and activities of our lives, the decisions that we make, or more likely, so we're probably the worst judges of ourselves, but also in particular, when we start doing that for other people. And I think that's why Jesus had the biggest issue with the Pharisees, mm-hmm. is that they were making declarations about lives that were not their own. And that is the reason why he took issue, because he's like, the woman caught in adultery. You don't know her story. You don't know where she's been and what put her there. Mm-hmm. But I do. You know, you don't know about this dude and the demons that are in him and the mental health things that are probably going on at the same time and why he's cutting himself with the pigs. Like, you don't know his story. Mm-hmm. Like, and you're sitting there saying that he is disqualified from what I'm doing in the world because of that. Like, no, no. Like, that's just not how that is. So when we do that, when we say that this person, because they don't have the right faculties, going back to Taylor, they don't have the right ability to like understand and logically, like they are they don't have something to contribute to society outside of like some sort of like sense of compassion that we should have for them. Like, no, like that is the antithesis of what God is doing in the world. That everyone has a part to play. Everyone has a unique gift. And nothing, no matter where you've come from, what you've been through, how you identify, what your ethnic heritage is, what your language you speak, you have something that God is going to do in you, in this world, like in me, in all of our stories. And like that is compelling to me. Mm-hmm. And that is the thing that I want to help. That's the thing that we try to do in Ecclesia. And that's why that No Perfect People thing helps as the funnel point for that is there are people in our midst at Ecclesia that wouldn't have shown up if that wasn't the tagline.
Right. That's so awesome. I love that.
But also, it also wouldn't have been, they would have seen through the tagline super quickly if we didn't have a community of people that really took it seriously.
Yeah, it's one thing to say it, and so right. another thing to live try. It.
And that, we're not perfect at it. I mean, like, there's, like you probably meet...
There's no perfect people. Alive, right, like, so no, you're not perfect.
Like,
yet.
Like yeah, there's probably 30 to 100 or 300 people in this town that probably be like, Ecclesia is full of garbage, you know? And yeah, sure, we are. Absolutely. At times, like, we're not perfect, you know? So,
right, right. Yeah, yeah. So, and I know we could talk forever, but I want to go back to something you said in the very beginning of our time together, which was you were talking about your experience growing up and being half Filipino,
yeah.
half white.
Norwegian. Yes.
And you also talked about your experience and how it reframed life for you and the gospel with your brother. And you were talking about how you have begun to look at what life is like for people in the margins who've been pushed aside and set aside. And you said something really interesting to me. You said, but you love to feel like you belong.
Yes, absolutely.
And those two things don't often work well together. Right. When you advocate for people in the margins, right. you often don't feel like you belong. That's because right. when you are a voice for justice, when you're a voice for people who cannot speak up for themselves,
yep.
you often get pushed out.
Absolutely.
You get misunderstood.
Sure.
You get judged. People don't like what you have to
right.
say. So tell me a bit about what that's like for you and encourage people listening who have that heart too, who want to speak up for those
right.
and do the work sure. of inviting people on the margins back into the fold of God and helping them know they're loved, but then how that threatens their sense of belonging.
Yeah.
How can you encourage them?
I would love to like be able to say that if you do these, like if it was a listicle on BuzzFeed, do these three things.
Yeah.
And you can have a prophetic voice and belong at the same time. I have yet to experience that. Another story from my own experience. I was preaching at a church one time, and I pressed some buttons. I pressed quite a few buttons. So I do believe this. Like, I really do believe this. I believe that Christian nonviolence is part of one of the core discipleship commitments that Christians need to make, that Jesus nonviolently gave himself up to death on a cross on our behalf. And so we should be able to do that even for our enemies. Like, and I don't like, I know I've been the minority there. Like, I really know that. And I essentially stated that at this church. I had this gentleman that, get this, he was on the hospitality team at this particular place, came up and said, and I mentioned the same things about being Filipino earlier. He told me to go back to the Philippines, like in the lobby of this church.
Wow.
Now, I think he was super flustered. So if I'm going to assume positive intent, I think what he meant is like, go back to the Philippines and try to be a pacifist there or believe in Christian nonviolence. I think that's what he meant. But what he said was, go back to the Philippines. Like, you don't belong here. And that's how upset he was. It's probably like, I've gotten fired from a church. I've gotten let go from another one. Like, and I can point to that moment being one of the most scarring moments in my history that has taken me a boatload of work. I said that in the past tense. It's taking me a boatload of work to let go. Mm-hmm. So I would love, there is nothing more than I would like to do than to like encourage people to say it, like, but I just don't know if it's going to happen. Like, I think the very nature, like, and part of it, it says this, is that if Jesus is our model for that, that Jesus wasn't killed by the moral rejects and the, like, people that had decrepit ethics, the drunks, the gang members. That's not who killed him. The people that killed him were well-meaning religious establishment. So if Jesus is our model and you live an authentically Jesus-filled life, I actually only think the cross is the end. Which is not encouraging at all.
What's on the other side of that is, but
yeah, what is on the other side of that is resurrection. Mm-hmm. But even if you notice in resurrection, Jesus holds the wounds of his crucifixion. Mm-hmm. Like in the resurrected Jesus, we don't get like pre-crucified Jesus, which is it's a profound theological issue. Like, I cannot describe to you that at one point God didn't know the suffering pain of the infliction of like wounds into flesh, rejection by those who were supposed to love him in a finite human body. Like, he got that from Israel multiple times in the transcendent understanding of it. But all of a sudden in Jesus, and what happens post-resurrection is so crazy, is that in Jesus, the suffering of humanity is brought up into the Trinity. It's an insane issue. Like, an insane idea that God understands that level of profound suffering. So much so that in Revelation, what we see is when Jesus is coming back, it says that his robes are covered in blood, but it's not the blood of his enemies because the battle hasn't been waged. It's his own blood, that it's still somehow being spilled all throughout history, that he's still suffering in the midst of that. What is on the back end of that is that you're like Jesus. And that's the only thing that we're offered in this world. In this world, there will be suffering, but take heart, Jesus says in John 16, I have overcome the world. That what is offered on the back end of that is that you look like Jesus. And I don't know anything more profound. Now, I could have said what I said in a million different ways. probably more wisely that would have probably made this dude not be so upset. And so there's wisdom in that. There's ways that you can say things. There's like, because there's also this thing that you can do. You're like, I'm going to say what I want to say. And when people get pissed, screw them, because that makes me more like Jesus. Like, that's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that as you authentically bring to the fore that which God has asked you to speak for, and people push against it, yeah, that makes you more like Jesus. That one thing I've had to learn is, because I have so much of my identity is wrapped up in my own success, so I've had to reframe what success is. And so, like, because for me, it's oftentimes quantitative. Like, the more people that I reach, the more people that I speak to, the more people that read my stuff, the more people, like, you know, like, it's, and it's stupid. Like, it's a stupid thing, but that's how I'm wired. And so I've had to redefine what success is in God's economy. Like, what is success in God's economy? What I'm able to see is that in God's economy, success is faithfulness to that which God has called you. Mm. That if you are faithful and obedient in the thing that God has called you to be and do and say and speak and operate in the world, that is success. And so, and you, like all success metric, you always are coming back to asking yourself that question. Okay, what am I called to? What am I? And that's why it's, I think that's also why it's so important that we know the voice of the Father. Because the only way that we can be faithful to that which God has called us into is that we know God's voice and what he's asking and what he's speaking, because that's what he's calling us to operate and be in the world. So, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot here. I keep hearing, as you're talking, I'm thinking about Isaiah and how, yes, Isaiah 53 says, by his wounds we are healed.
Right.
And there's this sense that because Jesus laid down his life,
right,
because he picked up his cross, right, you keep talking about that, laid down his life, we get invited into wholeness and, yeah, into healing.
Yes.
And in the same way, when we're called to be like him and speak up for those who can't speak up for themselves and create a world and bring his kingdom come and do the kind of work that he would do in this place,
right,
that's going to require us laying our life down. It's going to require sacrifice. It's going to require using a prophetic voice. It's going to require sometimes not feeling like we, right, belong with anybody but the people who we're trying to invite in,
right,
to know that they're loved and that their lives matter, right, the people on the margins, right? Right? And so I think very much a part of that life of advocating for people that Jesus would collide with and love. You know, we talked in the beginning, the first thing that I talked to you about was how when I asked people why they think you're so cool, you live and teach this idea that God loves people that we often don't.
Yeah.
And in order to do that kind of work, it, right, comes with sacrifice. It comes, absolutely, with the laying down of being misunderstood,
right,
and having to say things that are hard to, right, say and stand up for what's, yeah, right. And that is all being faithful.
Right. Absolutely. You know, and I'm really, like, I am super fortunate in what I get to do, because I will get to work with a population of people in emerging adults, young adults, that crave that, like, authenticity, that longing, like, for their lives to mean and be about something.
When you think about Taylor and what you've learned from him, tell me in one sentence, what's the good news of the gospel?
Yeah. The good news of the gospel of Jesus is that in Jesus, God is reordering the world to the way it was always intended to be, where humans partner with God to bring the restoration of all things, and everyone has a part to play.
I think lots of people are snapping their
fingers at that
one. That's it. That's, I love it. Yeah. I love it. Thank you for being on here today.
Yeah.
How can people keep up with you, Garrett?
Yeah. You can keep up with me on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. All my handles are at GShelsta. Most of my Instagram is a picture of my kids, so that's fine.
Look for a brood of beautiful babies.
Yeah. Or you can go to ecclesiabellingham.com, and our sermon podcast our sermons are up there. I have an incredible crew of people that speak there, not just me. And then we also have the Ecclesia After Hours podcast at ecclesiabellingham.com, where we respond to questions that people ask in our services, either online or otherwise. So that's the other thing.
That was awesome. Cool. And if you guys want to keep up with Collide, we're on Instagram at we.collide and on Facebook as Collide. And you can check out our website at wecollide.net. And if this encouraged you today, think about passing it on to a friend and sending it their way, and you can encourage them. And I encourage you to really think about the good news you've been invited into, which is that God is going to use you to bring restoration into this world today, tomorrow, and the rest of your life. Right. And so let's do it together. I'm excited about that. Catch you next week.